Welcome to this week's Friday feature on KWBU. Today, we hear from Dr. Candy Can. She spent her career studying how cultures understand death and dying. In her latest book, she turns the lens inward, exploring her own life as a deaf woman, navigating the world through hearing aids and technology. Today, on Living It, Candy shares stories and insights with host Meg Wallace. They also discuss her new book, Augmented, Life and Death as a Cyborg. Here's the conversation between Living It host Meg Wallace and Candy Can.
Candy, thanks for coming on the show. I invited you to be on the show because you have a new book coming out. Tell us about that, but we're going to kind of talk about that more later in the program.
Sure, Meg, and thank you for having me. It's great to be here. So the book is Augmented, and it is coming out with MIT Press next month, and I'm very excited about it.
What's the subtitle?
I have no idea.
What's it about?
Yeah, so it was actually, I wrote it during my Fulbright a few years ago in South Korea. And it's about the intersection of death and dying, technology and disability.
Whew.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sounds like it's going to be grim, but I bet it's not.
I'm excited about it. Yeah. And so the piece in South Korea is actually on robots. And I also have a chapter on augmentations. I have a chapter.
Augmentations of what?
So bodily augmentations. And this kind of gets to what you wanted to talk about today. So I wear hearing aids. I've worn hearing aids almost all my life since I was 4 years old. I also had cataract implants. I was born with congenital cataracts, so I was legally blind and had to get implants a few years ago. I was like the youngest person in that waiting room by far, like 10 years ago. So I just started thinking about, you know, these augmentations and the way in which we gradually, you know, either add pieces or lose pieces of our body over the years, and that kind of intersection with death and dying.
Yeah. So I want to get into that, but how, what was your journey toward this book? Well, first of all, you've had a very international upbringing.
I did. So yeah. My family worked for the government. So I grew up overseas in Guam and Thailand and Egypt, and then later on in Argentina. And then my family actually retired in Hawaii. So we moved all the time. I think I counted once. I went to 12 schools by the time I graduated from high school. So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, and as you're going through all this, your family started to realize that you had, that your hearing wasn't as they thought.
Yeah, that's right. So when I was four, apparently the story goes, you know how these family legends turn into lore over the years. But the story goes that my mom had asked me if I wanted some ice cream. And I love ice cream. I still love ice cream. I will totally always say yes to ice cream. And but she had asked me when I wasn't looking at her. My head was turned and I didn't respond. And so she says she knew then that there was something wrong with my hearing. But then my family took me to several doctors and the doctors just said, no, she's being willful. She's just being stubborn, she's not responding. And my mom was like, yeah, no.
We're talking about ice cream.
Yeah, we're talking about ice cream. Uh-huh. Yeah, so they discovered that I had, at the time, I had a 50% hearing loss. And that's not accurate. If you are familiar with hearing and hearing loss, it's essentially measured in frequencies and the percentage of frequencies that you can hear. But to simplify things, at that time, I had a 50% loss. And then when I was a graduate student at Harvard, as a young adult, I lost another 20% overnight. And then actually a few years ago here at Baylor, I lost another 20%. So I'm at a profound hearing loss now with a 90% loss. So I do wear behind-the-ear hearing aids. When I was young, I wore those, and then I moved to in the ear, and then gradually, as my hearing loss has become more profound, I have to wear behind the ear because it's the only thing that's big enough to let me carry around big speakers that I can hear from.
Big speakers?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean in terms of what's behind your ear is large enough that, I gotcha,
yeah.
I gotcha. Well, so you were telling me some really interesting stories about navigating your way through school.
Yeah.
You speak easily about hearing loss, but as we talked more, you were talking about hearing loss as a term and how you're also uncomfortable with it.
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing. In the deaf world, hearing people might not be aware of this, but there's a kind of cultural construct of hearing loss versus being deaf. And so because being deaf is a cultural construct and you you know, you have your own sign language and you operate in your own world. Some deaf people don't like hearing impaired people or people with hearing loss to use the term deaf. They feel like it's been misappropriated. But as I told you, I prefer the term deaf for me, mainly because I operate in a hearing world and I don't want to be seen and I don't view myself as having a deficit. So hearing loss to me implies that I'm less than, I'm not whole.
You've lost something.
Yes. Yeah. And I haven't. I really love the notion of deaf gain, which is a concept in deaf studies, that when you're deaf, you actually gain something. And I really feel like I do. I sleep so much better than anyone I know because I can take my hearing aids out at night and I don't have to hear a thing. I don't have to constantly work to filter out all the little noises. I remember when I got my hearing aids at Harvard, when I lost an additional 20%, it took a while to figure that out. It's kind of the way it works, right? So you become less and less aware of sounds. And it's only eventually you're kind of like, oh, wow, I'm missing out on a whole lot of sounds now. So I got new hearing aids, and all of a sudden I was like, I remember there was this loud humming in the kitchen, and it was so annoying. And I was like, oh, my gosh, it's a refrigerator. And so I went and unplugged the refrigerator.
Oh, bad idea.
Well, I was like, it's broken. It's making
a
loud
you thought it was
humming
broken.
Noise. Yeah. And then I told my roommates, I was like, our fridge is broken. And they were like, no, that's the sound a refrigerator makes. But I didn't know that, right?
No, right, right.
Yeah,
right,
so this is what I mean by deaf gain. I'm not having to listen to that kind of stuff
right,
the time. Like, I'm not listening to the clock ticking on the wall, the leaves scraping on the sidewalk. I mean, so there's this kind of benefit that hearing people don't realize that deaf people have, right? So
yeah.
All these hearing people now, everyone wants the Apple AirPods with noise cancellation because they can filter out all this noise. And I have that naturally.
That's right. Right. They're kind of trying to get some of the gain.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's why I prefer the term deaf.
Right. Right. But it's interesting because just when you're talking about it, you still talk about hearing loss, but kind of in the bigger sense.
In the more clinical sense to explain it to people.
No,
but
that
I really,
makes sense.
When I'm talking with friends, I'll just say, oh, I'm deaf.
Yeah.
I identify as deaf,
right.
Mainly because I operate in a hearing world.
Right. And so when you get a break from a lot of the noise,
yes.
But you also have an additional challenge because
yes.
You have to advocate for what you need. I mean, we had a conversation on the phone. And I was like, oh, that's like no problem for you. But it's not easy either, right?
No, it's exhausting. And I have special digital aids. They're very expensive. They cost me $6,000 a piece. So this is another
$6,000 a piece.
Yeah.
$12,000.
Now they're cheaper. Now
okay.
They're half the cost because technology is moving so rapidly, right?
Yeah.
So my next ones will be $6,000 for two.
What a bargain.
Yeah, so there are challenges, right? There's financial challenges. There's also just everyday challenges. I hate answering the phone. I mean, I know some people have anxiety around talking on the phone. But for me, if I am unfamiliar with your voice, or if I think we talked about this too, if I'm talking with someone who mumbles or who has a soft voice or someone who has a beard or a mustache, it's difficult because I do rely on lip reading. So, yeah, I find it kind of exhausting just to function. I have to work a lot harder than the average hearing person does.
Right. And during COVID and everybody had the face masks on.
Yeah. So that was really difficult. And I think we talked about this on the phone during COVID. It was the first time I had to really quote unquote out myself as deaf because everyone was wearing masks and I just couldn't understand anyone, right? I rely on lip reading. I have a funny story there too. When I came to Baylor, you have to give a teaching demonstration. And so I taught a class and they, you know, because I'm deaf, I move in between the desks so I can get in front of the person and see what they're saying. And so I can hear them. And all my they came up to me afterwards and they were like, wow, we loved how you interacted with the students. And you were right there and you just went right up to their desk. And I laughed. And I said, yeah, I'm deaf. I have to do that. So but
and they did they not know that before?
They had no idea. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So during COVID, I had to out myself and I went to Wes Null, our provost, vice provost at the time. And I was like, hey, I really need these lip reading masks, which are great. They're masks that have this clear plastic in them so that you can still see the person's lips. But I said, I need these masks for my students because otherwise I'm not going to be able to see what they're saying. And then I loved being online. Other people found it very frustrating. But for me, it was like a bunch of heads and I could see everyone in one place. And it made teaching so much easier and so much smoother. So I actually... I was online a year longer than anyone else, and I was so sad when we went back in person.
Oh, yeah,
it was
I bet.
Great. Yeah.
Do you ever use the captioning online?
Yes, I use. So that's one thing that's been kind of funny. So, I use the captioning on our TVs, too. And my kiddo said, oh, I've gotten to where I can't watch TV without the captioning now because you always use it. And she became a much faster reader because of that.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
But so I would think that in a TV program, they like if it's not live.
Yeah.
They've really made it accurate. But a lot of the captioning like on Zoom and whatever is automatic. How do you find that?
It's getting better. I mean, it's improving daily. That's the amazing thing about all these technologies, right?
Right.
Is it's really providing access in ways that even 5 years ago I wouldn't have had. So, yeah, it's fantastic. My favorite thing about TV captioning is when they say, like, slow, dramatic, sad music playing in the background. And I'm like, okay, I see which intention you had here.
Yeah, right. Now, when you went when you were away at grad school, you were you staying in a dorm during grad school? Is that
okay. At Harvard, I was in the graduate student dorm, so shall I tell this story?
Oh yeah.
Okay,
I love this story.
So I was in the graduate student dorm, and we had our orientation, and so the RA was telling us about fire drill and what to do in the fire drill. So I went up to the RA, and I was like, oh, by the way, I'm deaf, so just, you know, come get me if we have a fire drill. Well, next thing I know, I've got, like, two guys installing a buzzer, like a little doorbell thing outside my dorm room. And it's attached to a bed shaker. So essentially, if there's a fire drill, you know, you press the doorbell and then it wakes you up with vibrating your bed. But you can imagine, like, on a Friday night or a Saturday night, everyone's had, you know, a little bit too much fun and they're coming by and ringing the doorbell. So I had all my neighbors were like, what is this, Candy? And I was like, I have no idea. And then I went to the administration at Harvard.
So like, you could be like just laying in your bed reading or even asleep and all of a sudden your bed is shaking.
Yes. Obnoxious.
And you don't know if it's a fire alarm or what.
Right.
But they were just trying to help.
Yes. And they were helping without asking what help I wanted or what help I needed and
exactly.
What kind of intervention would be. So I did go to them and I told the administration, I said, I don't like this. You didn't consult me. You just assumed this was what I needed. And I said, think about it. Like, you know, I've already had multiple people come by and press the thing. it was removed rather quickly.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
That's good.
Yes.
But that was a lot of work. And by that time, you were a grad student, so probably more. I'm imagining an 18-year-old first time off on their own and having to navigate all that. And so what did they set up? Because that is a big issue. ability to evacuate a dorm is a big issue for people with disabilities going off to college, right?
Yeah.
So what did they come up with?
Well, and so they installed a light, right? So you see these in all fire alarms anyway. They have the light that will go off. And so I was a faculty in residence at Baylor for a few years, and mm-hmm. that's what Baylor did. They were like, oh, let's put a light in your room. I said, oh, that's great.
So, and it's not where it's activated by a doorbell outside your room.
No,
that anybody
it's not
can
activated.
Press.
No, it's activated by the fire alarm.
Oh,
so,
good.
Yeah. So, but these are the kinds of things that happen a lot to people with disabilities. They just have these interventions imposed on them by well-meaning non-disabled people, but without, you know.
Yeah. Helping can be good, but ask first.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, this is Living It. I'm Meg Wallace of Mobilize Waco, and today I'm talking with Candy Can, a professor of religion at Baylor University. She's just written a book called Augmented, published by MIT Press. So when I first heard about you, I heard about you from some colleagues in the BIC, the Baylor Interdisciplinary Corps. And I was just talking about, I don't even know how we got there, but we had been talking about how different churches handle different challenges in life and how they handle death and dying and funerals and things like mm-hmm. that. And they said, oh, you need to talk to Candy Can. So I first was aware of you as a scholar of that sort of thing. And your email signature says Death Scholar.
Yep. Deathscholar.com. Yep.
There you go. With a with like a skull.
Yes, a smiley skeleton.
Yeah. So you have fun with death.
I try.
How did you even get into that?
Yeah. So basically, when I did my master's in Asian religions at the University of Hawaii, I took a summer school course. It was 6 weeks long, every Saturday, all day Saturday. And it was called Death and Dying in Buddhist Culture. So we would meet in a different Buddhist temple.
Oh, Buddhist. Okay.
Yeah,
gotcha.
On the island every Saturday. And it was a full sensory experience. We would read, like for Tibetan Buddhism, we read the Tibetan Book of the Dead. We then heard Tibetan funerary chanting, and then we ate Tibetan food for lunch. And so it was this multi-sensory experience, and I was like, oh, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to do with my life. And I did this really cool paper for that on Chinese funerary food rituals. There's a cemetery on the island of Oahu, and when you drive by it, there's always like Big Macs and shakes on the tombstone. So I was really interested in, why are these people feeding the dead? This is so interesting to me. So from then on, I became fascinated by death and dying.
And it's interesting you said it is a multi-sensory experience. I think Americans, and especially white Americans, everything's about talking and listening, right?
Yeah.
And we just... How did you see the different senses being incorporated into those experiences?
Yeah, so a lot of places around the world, they are incorporating different rituals and practices. I've done some work on, for example, I had a book called Dying to Eat, and I recently did a bibliography for Oxford Bibliographies on food rituals surrounding death and dying. So I really... You know, for example, Protestants generally will have like a lunch after a funeral service. And the function of the food and that kind of service is really to tell stories about the deceased, but it's also to put the deceased into their place as a dead person, right? So they've moved from living to dead. And now the community's gathering and sharing stories and kind of resituating or restructuring their community without the dead person. Whereas, you know, if you go to, say, a Chinese funeral, you're actually going to be making offerings to the dead, and you're going to be feeding the dead. So there's this different kind of sense in which the living are caring for the dead, as opposed to simply remembering them. So I'm really interested in those distinctions, and I love looking at material culture and things like that.
I can imagine the visuals, the taste, the smells of the food. And there's probably movement and dancing in certain places and things like that. And you know, that gathers all of us, not just all of us in terms of all the people, but all of who each of us is, right? I just think that's beautiful. And I think in a disability context, that's extremely important, because if you can't engage fully in one part of it, you can engage in this other part of it, right?
Yeah, and it really ties to, for me, thinking about disability, you know, one out of every three Americans, around 26% of Americans, officially identify as disabled, right? So it's one of the largest minority groups in the United States today. But as you age, you are more and more likely to become disabled. And over half of all Americans, approximately 51% of all Americans, will end up disabled in their final months of life. So,
yeah.
And then you add to that medicalized dying and people going to hospitals and dying in hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
Then you also have this kind of another layer on top of that, right? So I think it's really important to think about disability and death, which is why I wanted to kind of write that book about that.
Right, right. Now, you told me that you, I can't remember the name of it now, you came up with a document for when people are going to the hospital that gives instructions. I'm really scared of the prospect of needing to be in full nursing care because I have an anaphylactic food allergy that's very hard to avoid.
Right.
Pepper.
Okay.
Wow. Like red pepper.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's in everything. You wouldn't even
especially
think
in Texas.
Oh, right. But I mean, most, it's very hard to find products on the shelf even that don't have an ingredient that's dangerous to me. So that's really scary. And what would I do? Right.
Yeah.
And there's, and then for you, because of your hearing needs, right? So tell me about this document you came up with.
Yeah, so one of the things I really advocate for is for people to have a power of attorney, for people to have a living will, so that if you are unable to talk about your wishes, you're able to do that through this legal document. But what we're missing are two other things, and they are both appendices in the book. And one of them is a digital remains will, right? We have more and more digital assets that we're not thinking about that we do need to think about. And who's going to have access to our social media and our digital accounts once we die? But the other one I made is a hospital accommodation plan for disability. Because so many of us are disabled or know someone who is disabled, we have to figure out a way to advocate for these disabilities and needs when we're in the hospital. And studies have really proven that you have 50% more positive outcomes in general well-being when you have an advocate on your behalf. But if you're by yourself or you don't have an advocate, then this is a way that you can create advocacy on your behalf ahead of time from a legal standpoint that a hospital will have to honor. And so I really think this is super, super important. We also see a 25% reduction in hospital readmissions when you have good advocacy. So it's going to help your general well-being.
Well, right. And you might have someone who really cares about you and wants to advocate for you, but you never thought to talk about
your allergy, your sensory needs, your need for glasses, your need for an interpreter. I mean, there's so many things.
When my father-in-law was dying and he was very hard of hearing, they took his hearing aids out. But then we were trying to talk to him and it's like, oh, but he can't hear that.
Yeah.
So let's think about this ahead of time. Yeah. Do you think you would want your hearing aids in? Do we want to really make that make sure that happens, you know?
Well, and hospital staff might make a misjudgment based on that, right? So, for example, let's say I get in a car crash, my hearing aids fly out. They come to me, medical staff try to take care of me, and they say, oh, she's unresponsive. Well, maybe I'm just not hearing you.
Right.
I might be responsive if I can hear you. So these are really important things to have in place.
Right. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So augmented. How did you get from your life as a death scholar to augmented does talk about technology around death, but also technology for the living?
And, yes.
Throughout your life. Right?
Yes.
So
basically it was a couple of things. One was thinking about my life as a deaf person and the fact that I consider myself to be an augmented person, right? I wear hearing aids. I have these lens implants. And I really think that augmentations are valuable to who I am. They're an essential and crucial part of my identity. And so I really wanted to explore that. So there's an advocacy piece of the book where I'm trying to get people to think more intentionally about this, and advocating for the disabled in dying situations. But then there's the other piece where essentially, I argue we're all augmented beings of some kind, right? Mm-hmm. We all use our phones. We all use our computers. We use these kind of technologies on a daily basis, even if we're not disabled.
And so it shouldn't be stigmatized.
It shouldn't be stigmatized. And, you know, one of the things I see is aging adults who might be resistant to wearing hearing aids because they're afraid of the stigmas that will occur when they put on the hearing aids. Well, I've had hearing aids my whole life. And, you know, I think there's so much data that shows you're more likely to have dementia if you don't wear hearing aids. So it's a really important intervention.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that was part of the decision of my husband getting hearing aids. Yeah. My mom had dementia. And let's keep our brains strong as long as we can.
Yes.
But, you know, it's funny because there's stigma around hearing aids but not around glasses.
Right?
Why?
I have no idea
it makes
why.
No sense.
Yeah. Yeah, there's stigma around mental health, but not around glass. I mean, why?
Yeah, yeah, it makes no sense. So, when does your book come out?
It comes out next month. I'm so excited about it.
Okay, so we have a disability and community book group,
ooh,
and I want to suggest this for our next book.
Okay,
so
I would love that.
Hopefully, it will be out in time to.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. We talked for 2 months, so we're on our first month on a book. So then that would put us into April. I think we'd be safe.
Yeah, that'd be out just in time.
Yeah. The book is Augmented, Life and Death as a Cyborg. A cyborg.
Yes, I'm a cyborg. I'm part tech and part human.
So that's what cyborg means.
Yeah.
So what is the most important contribution? We're right at the end of our conversation, but if you could just sum up in a moment, what's the most important contribution that you hope this book is going to make?
I hope that people will be less resistant to technologies surrounding disability and also think more intentionally about their needs in the dying process and their needs for their families in the dying process. There's lots of really amazing technologies out there to help people as they're aging. And if we can be less afraid of that technology, then I think our lives will be better.
Yeah. Yeah. And if people can be proactive.
Yes.
About considering what they may need and their loved ones might need. Sounds like a great book.
Thank you, Meg.
Thanks for coming on.
It was my pleasure.
The book is Augmented, Life and Death as a Cyborg. All right. I can't wait to read it.
Living It, our third Friday feature every month on KWBU. Find past episodes online at kwbu.org. Look in the programs tab.